So notice what your mind is doing. If it's waggling, roaming, shooting back and forth. If you're here. If you're at your home. Your life is created by where you put your energy, where you put your attention. Where you put your attention is where you put your energy. What you pay attention to grows. What you pay attention to grows. A good maxim for living is only pay attention to what you want to grow. For the most part, we pay attention to what's wrong. And then we're surprised when what's seemingly wrong takes up more and more space. Well, it takes up more and more space because that's what we're paying attention to. And then it takes up more space and we pay attention to it more because it's taking up more space. And we want to change, but we want to change by fighting and resisting and wanting to fix and wanting to change and get rid of what we don't like. And that actually doesn't work, as all of you know, because otherwise you wouldn't be here. I just was having a very intense discussion with Loren, who is our beloved retreat, I don't know what to call her, but guide is what I would call her. She is the one who does, if you choose to be in a small group, after this, and many of you already are in small groups with her, but, she and I have been working together for, I don't know, more than 15 years, maybe 20 years. And we were just having a very intense discussion about GLP-1s. And, all the people we know, particularly I know, good friends who are, well, except for a couple who keep falling down on the kitchen floor and finding themselves 2 hours later waking up because they fell asleep and they don't know how they got there because they're so tired, they're so fatigued. But most of the friends that I know who are on GLPs love them. Love them. Why do they love them? Well, they love them because they've lost weight, and they love them because the food noise has stopped. This is what got Loren and I into our very heated discussion about this. Because she was saying, isn't it great that Miranda no longer has food noise? And she's so happy she no longer has food noise. And I said to her, so what? So what? There's always going to be noise of some kind going on in your head. So she doesn't have food noise anymore. What other kind of noise does she have? Does she have self-rejecting noise? Does she have noise about the shape of her body? Does she have noise about her relationship? Does she? What does the mind do? And Lorenz said, but she remembers a time in the 1970s when she was either eating or thinking about eating and how awful it was. And I did say to her, it was only awful because you wanted it to go away. If you didn't mind that you were either eating or thinking about eating, it wouldn't have been awful. It just would have been the way it was. It just would have been that. Things are awful when you want them to not be as they are. And the big thing with this mind is that when you look between the thoughts, when you look at the space between the thoughts, when you don't take your thoughts personally, when you don't think your thoughts mean anything about you, when they come because that's the conditioning. I have particular trains of thought that have been there forever. Seems like my mother has those trains of thoughts too. Seems like it was just handed down. A legacy of trained, particular flavors of thoughts. Not everybody has the same flavor of thoughts, but we all do. We've got thoughts. The question for me is, and I am not on one side or the other of GLP. People keep on trying to get me to say I agree or I don't agree, and I'm just not there. What I am in favor of is not fighting and not resisting and not wanting to change, manipulate, get rid of, but simply allow and receive the way it is. If what I said to Loren is, well, I'm usually either eating or thinking about eating. That's what's true for me for at least part of the day. Not all of the day. By the afternoon, I'm kind of done. Done with thinking about food. I don't really think about it again till it's time for me to eat the next day. But it doesn't bother me. I don't really feel like it needs to change. I just say, there it is, and I don't. The hardest part is when we believe what comes into our minds means something about us. Means that, oh my God, something's wrong with me. Oh my God. I have to change this. Oh my God, this is awful. When we feel like it means something. Now, I do want to back up and say, the body takes the hit of our thoughts when we believe them. The body takes the hit. The body has been taking the hit of our thoughts, like that book, I think it was Dorje's book, The Body Keeps the Score. This is another iteration or valence of that. The body takes the hit. We take our thoughts out, our beliefs out on our poor bodies. Starve them, abuse them, deprive them, stuff them, push them. So the basic identification we have is with this body. I am the shape of my body. I am my body. And we try to fix ourselves by fixing our bodies. That doesn't mean that if we're uncomfortable in our bodies, if our bodies are not at ease, if it's hard to get around, if it's hard to move, if it's, you know, a kind of basic unease in this body, of course we need to work with our bodies. Of course we need to just figure out what would be the kindest thing to do for my body now. How can I treat my body as my beloved pet? How can I treat my body as my beloved pet? If Izzy was sick, would I just kind of yell at her or stuff her, or she doesn't want to eat? Would I force her to eat? If she just went to lay down, would I have some words with her? Izzy's my dog. No, I would not. She's my beloved pet, but what about this body? What about this? What I have done to my body over the years, not what I'm doing now, but what I did for so many years was shocking. Shocking. In Love, Finally, I have a chapter called The Body Project. Maybe we did this in a retreat, I can't remember. I made a list of the things I had done to my body over the years, and it was exhausting. It took up pages, including wrapping my thighs in saran wrap and, you know, doing 100 jumping jacks and being on, I didn't go on the Sleeping Beauty diet, but I did interview people who did, meaning that when you rest, you lose a lot of weight. When you sleep, you lose a lot of weight. Or the all-white diet, or whatever diet there was. The diets were just a little part of what I did. I was against my body. We usually have a transactional relationship with our bodies. I will do this if you do that. I'll eat less if you lose weight. We have a transactional relationship with almost everybody in our lives. If I give you this, what will you give me back? It's not, as somebody I know says, I can't remember where she got that from, some teaching she did, let love radiate without concern for results. How would that be? Without concern for results. Do we ever do anything without concern for results? Are we almost always? But what am I going to get from this? What is this going to give to me? I'll give you this if you give me that. Matt and I had a house guest the last couple of days. A friend of Matt's forever and ever and ever. And he was lovely to be with. And as he was leaving yesterday, I thanked him. I never like house guests. House guests come into my house and I think, okay, how long are they going to be here and is it time for them to leave? You know, I'm kind of ready immediately for them to leave. So he stayed for 3 nights. And when Matt first asked me, is it okay if he stayed for 3 nights? I'm like, oh, no, it's not. But anyway, he's a really close friend of Matt, and I thought, okay, fine. And we had a great time. We had a really, really good time. And as he was leaving, he said to me, I said, you know, I've had such a sweet time with you, Stanley. And he said, well, I know how to make myself useful as a house guest. I said, you know what? That's not the reason I had a good time with you. Because of what you could give to me, because of what you could do for me, it was you. I had a good time because you were you. and I like being with you, but we don't usually go to that level. What can you give me? What do I need to give you? So in terms of our bodies, it's not about food noise or no food noise. And the friends I've had who have told me that there's no food noise are totally thrilled. These are people who have been in therapy forever and ever and done a lot of inner work, and they just feel released that there's no food noise. And my question is, but what about those conclusions that led you to start eating to begin with? I'm a failure, I'm not enough, something's wrong with me. I'm a mess. I don't matter. Are those dissolved with the food noise? No. But, you know, without the preoccupation with food, some of those do lighten up, according to them. I don't know. Having not been on a GLP, although I'll tell you, a couple of months ago when a friend of mine was telling me that, you know, being on a, I think it was tirzepatide, a compounded version of tirzepatide, had taken away all of her belly fat, which I have accumulated since being on the post-cancer medication. Sometimes I think I could, you know, balance a little teacup on my belly. I thought for 10 minutes after I got off the phone with her, what a good idea, taking tirzepatide, getting rid of the belly fat. I could do that. That would be great. And then I thought, and then what? So I'd get rid of the belly fat. Of course, I don't know what else would happen. I don't know what any of the other side effects would be. But all that aside, which many people are putting aside right now, so what? What does having no belly fat, or little belly fat, or visceral fat, as my doctor says, surrounding my many organs, and I don't even know that he knows that's true. I'm not sure anybody knows anything anymore. That's what I have to say. This is supposed to do this, and this is supposed to do that, and it's like, really? But how do you know? Wasn't margarine supposed to be good for you before it wasn't? Wasn't Oprah supposed to be fabulous for you before it was terrible for you? Wasn't sugar the big thing? Wasn't aluminum foil the major thing? What about plastic? Wasn't that like the best invention? And now microplastics are in everything and you're feeding on microplastics, particularly if you eat apples and carrots and broccoli, and it's like, oh my God. So if I didn't have any belly fat, what then? What then? Is that going to help me live fuller? Is that going to help me be more alive? Now, I am already very comfortable in this body. It has different amounts of pain. I have a bunch of compression fractures, ongoing breast pain from the scars from the lumpectomy, hip pain. You know, as Ram Dass calls it, the organ recital. There's my hips, my back, the this, the that. Let me tell you about the organ recital that's going on here. Aside from that, if I don't identify with that, if I just notice, there's hip pain. Oh, that's right. If I lean on this side, this is what happens because of the lumpectomy scar. But if I don't take myself to be it, if that's what's passing through, if that's what I said last night, what's come to pass, if I can witness it without jumping on it and resisting it, remember, the second you want something to go away, it keeps it around. the second you want it to go away. Because then you're in resistance, and resistance equals suffering. And that's how it always goes. There's never a time when that's not true with anything or anyone. Can I just let it be? Can I be a body? Can I have this? If you can have it, you aren't it. If you can see it, you aren't it. So I have belly fat, but I'm not belly fat. There's a difference there between what you have and who you are. I've got an orange folder here. Am I the folder? No. I've got belly fat. Am I the belly fat? No. I can become aware of it without being it. The most of the work we're doing, and we are going to do the visualization in a second, most of the work we're doing is about changing the perception, changing the identity from being someone who believes she is her body and she is her thoughts and she is what occurs to her. You know, if you weren't your thoughts, there'd be no problem. As the Zen Buddhists say, no mind, no problem. No self, no problem. No problem at all. So if you didn't take yourself to be your thoughts, there wouldn't be any problem at all. It would just be the way it is. And that would be and is such a relief. And that's what we're doing. We're doing a perceptual shift between taking ourselves to be our minds, our thoughts, our feelings, and our bodies, our body-mind. That's a way of saying it. Our body-mind identification, BMI, body-mind identification. We so identify with this that the greatest riches of all which are the ability to know that you're not who you think you are, which is the ability to be aware, to know that you are the awareness through which all these realities arise. You are the awareness through which all these realities arise. Now, many of you are probably thinking, so what? When am I going to lose weight? So what? All that sounds good. So the more you know who you are when you don't identify with your body, the easier it is to be on your own side. The easier it is to treat your body as your beloved pet, to treat your body like you would your dog or your cat. Or Matt and I, we were leaving Whole Foods a couple months ago, maybe 2 months ago, and I saw these birds. We were in Hawaii, and there were these mina birds there, and they were fighting with one bird, and they were picking on one bird. And that bird that they were picking on looked like it was really having a tough time. It was 90 degrees outside, and they wouldn't let that bird go. And Matt said to me, you know, they might be helping that bird die quickly. That might be what they're doing. And I said, you know what? I don't care what they're doing. I'm picking up that bird now. So I got some gloves and I picked up the bird and that poor little bird. So treating my body like I would treat this poor little bird. And that bird kind of cocked its head and looked up at me. We called the wild animal rescue They said, bring it over right now. I wrapped it up in, I can't remember what I wrapped it up in, but so that it could still breathe. And we drove over quite a way to this volunteer's house, and I handed her the bird, who was just warm and just so sweet, but not doing very well. And she picked the bird from my hands, and I checked in with her about 2 hours later. And I said, so what happened? She said, well, the bird really didn't make it. It was too far gone. But I did give the bird some Xanax so that it could relax and it could calm down and it could have a very peaceful passing. It was warm and relaxed and sweet. Of course, I cried and I cried. I mean, I didn't even know the bird for longer than 10 minutes, but I'm just like on the phone crying about this bird. But if I had only treated my body like that for so many years, well, first of all, I probably wouldn't be here right now, because I wouldn't have had to crawl back from an extreme amount of self-abuse. But that bird, I haven't ever forgotten that bird. I mean, it's only been a few months, so ever isn't very long now. But I think of the sweetness, and I think of that I really didn't have any choice. Matt was like, you know, if you pick it up, blah, blah, blah. I said, you know what? I'm picking it up. I have gloves. I have we have a towel. I'm doing it, even if they were trying to give it a faster death. I didn't want it to die being picked on in the hot sun. So that was me. So treating our bodies like we would treat a beloved bird. Like we would treat a beloved bird. That's how sweet our bodies are. That's how sweet they are. Okay, before we do the visualization, are there any questions? Anybody's got any questions about what I have said so far, how this applies to you? I need a glass a little closer than over here. Kathy, thank you. No questions? All right, well, if there's no questions, then I want to go around the room and have you each say a sentence about where you are right now. Rachel, will you start? Rachel is up here. Rachel is right over here. Raise your hand. One sentence and move it.
Yeah.
Quickly.
No.
Step on it, Rachel.
I'm calm.
Your name first?
Karen.
Yes. Okay.
Absorbing and processing.
Amy. Feeling a bit sad for my body.
Indeed.
Leslie, I love this.
Angie, that bird story just really touched me. So that is my new goal. Thank you.
Yes.
Julie, peaceful, calm, glad to be here.
Peaceful and what?
Glad to be here.
And there's the second Rachel.
Yes, Rachel. Very grateful for your perspective on the GLP-1s. I appreciated that.
Lauren, feeling very sweet.
So behind you, Jacqueline.
Jacqueline, I'm here.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Grace, I feel sad and anxious.
Jane, I feel centered and peaceful and happy to be here.
Thanks, Jane. Kathy?
Kathy, I feel tender-hearted.
You know, sadness about the way we've treated our bodies seems appropriate to me because of how we flogged it over the many, many years. And how we haven't learned, and certainly it's not taught to us in the cultural reality. The cultural perspective is not treating your body as a beloved pet. The cultural perspective is, if you do that, then you'll lapse over into self-indulgence. And, you know, what if your body was like your dog who wanted a biscuit every 30 seconds? you could take it that far. You could say that there's fear about treating my body kindly. Fear that if I treat it with sweetness and kindness and, you know, what does it actually want? Even though you could say, well, it might want a biscuit, if, like, a dog every 5 minutes? Nah. Not if it was really given a full voice. If it was really, sweetheart, what now? What now? Yeah. So, Angela, right?
Yes, Angela. I do feel sad for how I've treated my body, but I also feel intrigued and hopeful.
Good.
Jenny, I feel like peeling the layers of the onion, so anxious but curious.
Yeah.
Gina, I'm compassionate with myself and understanding that the way of surviving, it was treating very bad to my body. It was better than feeling the pain.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Nicole, and I'm feeling curious.
Great. And then Arzu, yep.
I almost left because my thermostat is broken. I just get very hot very fast. I'm glad I stayed. It's very invigorating.
Leslie, I feel relaxed and focused.
Lisa, I feel present, clear, and I'm just really taking in the good and the beauty of this work. It's very nourishing.
Cheryl, and I'm feeling very calm today and peaceful. And I know there's stuff I should be worrying about, but I'm not. I'm letting that go.
I should be worried. Now that is a very, very interesting statement. An utter lie, but still quite interesting. I should be worried because worrying helps so much, doesn't it? Worrying really solves a lot of problems. Worrying, Michael Fox said this. Maybe it's Michael J. Fox. I get confused about which one is Michael J. Fox and which one is, but anyway, the one with Parkinson's, Jay, said that worrying about something is utterly useless because if the thing happens to happen, then it's happened twice. First when you worried about it and the second time, but also another friend of mine said worrying is like rocking back and forth in a rocking chair. You get nowhere. You just keep on worrying.
And I know that.
Yeah.
Kim?
Yeah.
And I'm excited. My children are my two dogs.
and I know how compassionate and loving I am to them.
Right.
So I'm excited to be that way for myself.
Yes, good. Thank you, Kim.
Nancy, I am relieved and open and curious.
Jessica?
Jessica. Yeah, I just feel embraced and loved.
I'm Rona. I'm thinking about how my self-worth has created some contractions around how I love and care for myself and others, and reflecting on what that's been like for me and what it would take to get to that point of with the bird.
With the bird, yes.
Joyce, and I feel grateful. I went on a walk and was gifted these beautiful feathers on the trail, and it reminds me of just this moment of what you're sharing feels like, the gifts too. So open to those gifts.
Yeah, good. You know, I do realize that even for those of you who have been doing this work for quite a while, it's still a radical shift. It's still a shift to go from taking yourself to be this me person, this body-mind, to whom things happen that you don't really have any control over, that there's an external world out there that just seems to happen. And it's doesn't have anything to do with your, we can call it frequency, with the energy that you're constantly putting out. You know, you already have the direct experience of when you're in an expansive mood, a wonderful mood, everything around you is expansive and wonderful. You already have that experience. You know that how you are affects everything you perceive. That's the direct experience of as viewed, so appears. As viewed, seeing through these particular lenses that I see through, affects what I see, and therefore what comes back to me. I think that's the piece that we don't often put together, that what we put out, and sometimes it only seems that we can tell what we put out by what comes back to us, but we don't even make the connection then. We think we're at the effect of it. We think it just happens. We think we're not anything to do with what we perceive, with what happens. Like my friend and the radiation who ended the relationship, I just, when it first happened, I didn't think I had anything to do with it. I thought she was brutal and horrible, and I was also at the same time ashamed of myself. So I didn't quite get that our relationship was made of my view of myself, and how she treated me had to do with what I put out. It matched. Like attracts like. We'll do further work with this throughout our time together today and tomorrow, but in the work we're doing, there is no blame. There's no blame. No blame. It's about me. It's about me. What I put out, what my feelings are, what my beliefs about myself are, and how that affects what comes back to me. I just feel like that's the radical, well, there are two radical turns. It's about me, and also how what I'm putting out affects what I get back. Because we don't like to think about that. We like to think they're crazy or this is awful or what a shit show or, you know, that's out of control or I didn't have anything to do with that. And I'm not saying that you absolutely have 100% control because you don't. But you do have I don't know what the word is. I don't really like the word responsibility. I don't really like the word accountability because it's been used in so many sharp ways. But you are absolutely part of what you're experiencing from out there. It's not out there. We've got it backwards. We see the world, the world we see is our projection of ourselves looking like the world. That's how it looks. And the last thing I'm going to say before we do the visualization is that we're really working on, if you can say it like this, even though they're the same level, two levels. We're working on the level of food itself, what we do with food, our relationship to these beloved pets of ours. We could call it to the birds of our bodies, going from that little sweet bird I found on the ground. And we're looking also and working with a metta perspective of it, of not this body. Because, you know, if we were our bodies when we died, and, you know, I don't know if you've ever been with people who have died, but the people I've been with who died, and I remember my father being with him, his body, after he died, he wasn't there anymore. I mean, it was obvious he was just a shell. Well, why spend all this time working on this shell that we just leave behind? Why do that? Well, we do that because this is the only place where we can realize presence and our true nature. Because it is through having a body that we realize that. And so we need to take good care of this physical vehicle. Otherwise, we'll be a wreck. And it will be really hard to be clear and spacious. But what we're really doing is learning how to become, you know, to say our best self. We want to live our best lives. You know, that's the physical worldly way of saying that what we want to do and what we're doing and what everything we do here and everything I write about. In fact, I forgot to say that Love Finally is a story about the process of going from being utterly wounded to not being wounded. It's about the steps to take. It's about how, it's also about how to do it. It's not just about my mother, although it starts with her, because just like food, that's a way in. The beliefs that I have mostly came from the relationship with my mother, or how I interpreted the relationship with my mother. So what we're doing here is learning how to be this, to have wings, to be clear, to be spacious, to be present, to understand that we are everything. We really are the awareness through which all of this unfolds. To live as if, you know, we used to do an exercise, I think it was in the retreats, it might have been in the workshops, called Live As If. And it was live as if you loved yourself. Walk as if you're thin. Walk as if you're already at the weight you want to be at. Now, that might not be thin, but walk as if, eat as if, live as if you already are who you know the promise to be. Because the only thing that's keeping you from it is your belief that you can't have it and that you're not it. You know, before I was on Oprah for Women, Food, and God, I'd been on Oprah for When Food is Love. And so Women, Food, and God came out 15 years or 14 years after When Food is Love. I already knew I was going to be on Oprah before the book came out, even though my publishing company was just, you know, nah, we're not really expecting this book to do anything. We've only published a couple thousand copies. I kept saying, it's time to publish more. I saw myself sitting with her. I knew it. And I was treating myself as if it had already happened. And that's what I'd like you to do. To consider being. So be the energy that you'd be to feel what you want to feel. Be that now. Why wait? It wasn't, of course, that maybe I've told some of you this story, and maybe I haven't, until I was sitting with Oprah doing hours of radio shows with her, which was really fun, but it was quite a few hours. And she asked me afterwards, so how's your publisher doing in terms of the book, in terms of its printing? And I said, they just won't print. There's just like 2,000, 3,000 books. They just won't print anymore because the print run depends on how many people buy the book. And my book before Women, Food, and God was The Craggy Hole in My Heart, maybe. I can't remember. And that sold 2.5 copies. And so the publishing company was not really willing to publish more than a couple thousand copies at a time because they weren't getting orders for my next book from the bookstores. And Oprah said to me, well, why don't you get them on the phone? And get your publisher on the phone. I was like, really? Get my publisher on the phone? And so I walked into her office. I dialed my publisher's number. I had her number in my mind. I got her on the phone, Susan Moldau. She was the president of Scribner, which was a subsidiary of Simon & Schuster. And I said, Susan, somebody wants to talk to you. And I handed the phone to Oprah. And Oprah got on the phone, Susan, this is Oprah Winfrey. And it's time for you to print 800,000 books. And Susan said to me afterwards, that was the best moment of my whole life. You know, it wasn't seeing Leonard Cohen at the Beacon Theater. It wasn't marrying her husband. It wasn't having her kids. It was when I handed the phone to Oprah Winfrey, and she got off the phone and ordered a print run of 800,000 books, from 2,000 books. To 800,000 books. But I was already living as if that had happened. That's what I'm saying. Be how you want to feel and feel how you want to be. Be how you want to feel and feel how you want to be. Susan continues to say to this day, she's now retired, but when I talk to her, she says to me, the two defining moments of my life, the day you handed the phone to Oprah and the day I was talking to her when I walked into my kitchen and there was a 7-foot snake on my kitchen floor and I started screaming. And Susan lives in Manhattan and there are no snakes in kitchen floors on 30th floor apartments, but we laugh about that all the time. Told that to Oprah. I haven't had the chance to say, it was you and the snake. together. Now, did that happen because I already saw it happening? When you be how you want to feel and feel how you want to be, it doesn't matter. Because what you want most to happen, if you feel like it's already happened, or if you feel like you already are who you would be and what you would be if it happened, what difference does it make? Now, did it make a difference to Matt and me financially? Yes. We had lost every cent of our money to Bernie Madoff. And then Oprah happened. And then we got every cent of our money back within a very short time. Or as a friend of mine said, you sure weren't poor for very long. And it made a difference financially, but it didn't make a difference to me. There's a difference. Be how you want to feel. Feel how you want to be. Be the energy you would be if how you see yourself, the promise of yourself, had already happened. We live with such limitation. Don't allow ourselves the vastness and the majesty of our true nature, which is ever expansive, ever expansive. And wouldn't consider abusing anything with food. Because when you're living in that, as that, you have everything you ever wanted. And it has nothing to do with food. Or flat bellies, for that matter. Okay, everybody. So, take some long, deep breaths in and let them out. We're going to do the visualization that we often open with, open the retreats with. With a little added extra. Take some long deep breaths in. If you feel to, put your index finger and middle finger on the center point of your heart. And allow your mind to drop down into your heart. And ground that with three deep breaths. Three deep breaths, belly breaths, a belly breath. If you cough, when your belly sticks out and you breathe all the way in and then up through your nose. And then pause and then out through your mouth. And then again. All the way up through your nose. Pause and out through your mouth. Up through your nose, all the way up, up, up. And out through your mouth. And let yourselves relax, your sweet selves, these beloved pets of our bodies. becoming aware of yourself sitting in this chair, in this room. And then just being with yourself, your consciousness. And know that each of us right now is at a life transition point, whether overt or subtle, of something that is falling away and something that's being born. Turn to that in you now which is falling away. Even if you don't know what it is or not, everybody has something falling away. It may be as real as someone dying or a relationship ending or a job that's changing or leaving a job. It could be getting older, having the young body shift into an older body. It could be on an inner level, a way of being. Someone we've been that is being shed like a snake sheds its skin. What is it that's dying in your life right now? What is it that you're letting go of right now? And within your inner sanctuary, your inner space, honor that which is dying. You can see yourself honoring it. Acknowledging is honoring. And then I'd like you to turn towards what is being born, what is coming into being. It could be an actual circumstance in your life, or a new way of being, or something you can't even name. You don't even know what it is. Could be still in the birthing process, in the womb, still in the struggle of the birth canal. Maybe you can just sense the air and the light that is coming towards you. Maybe it's already out of the womb in its early stages. What is being born? What is coming into being? Acknowledge that, the new beginning. And then turn towards that in you that goes beyond birth and death, that was never born and will never die. That which has been present in the background throughout all the struggles and celebrations of your life and was there before and after them. Who you are without the story. Who you are without your story. Who you are when you don't identify yourself as this me person, as this body-mind unit. And be with that, feel that, sense that. Just who you actually are without your story. You. Unfolded, blooming. You as the promise of yourself. Imagine that. You're being who you know you are, being what you want to feel and feeling what you want to be as you already are it. Seeing that. Imagining that. And then, out of all the symbols in the whole world, allow a symbol of that you to occur to you. A touchstone to bring it back. It could be anything. A crystal, a hummingbird. Star. Could be anything, a feather. Allow yourself to come up with one. You as you are, as you're blooming. Already know her, you already are her. Have a symbol of her and bring it back here right now. So that anytime in the next hours and days and weeks and months to come, you have that. That reminder of who you are. As the reality in which all realities arise, as the awareness, as the presence, as the radiance of yourself. And then gently, gently, slowly, slowly bring your awareness back to this room, to the presence of your feet on the floor, your butt in the chair. Of occupying this physical vehicle. And when you have a sense of being back here, open your eyes. So we're going to divide in groups of two right now, groups of two, for you to be with your partner and tell her about what is dying, what is being born. You had a sense of what never dies and the symbol, your symbol. Your touchstone for your glorious self. Okay, please stand up and find a partner. You can put your index finger up in the air. It doesn't matter if you already have one. You can just keep sitting down. And then knee to knee so that you're facing your partner. Jay needs a partner. Jen, you might be in a group of three then. So, Jen, you can be with Kathy and Arzu if you want. Okay, fine. Jacqueline, and it's great. Wherever you want to go. Okay, so you need a timer because I'd like you to time yourself. One person needs to have a timer. Each of you has 3 minutes. 3 minutes. And again, no crosstalk, no chatter. This isn't a conversation. This isn't an oh me too. This isn't the same thing happened to me and here's what happened to me. This is utterly and only listening. If you're listening. If you're speaking, it's you speaking, just speaking. That's it. Okay, please go. Seems like we're still sitting in the Arctic over here. So, what'd you put it up to, Judy? You put it up to what? Okay, let's see how it goes. Otherwise, we're going to be shivering, and it's going to be summer, and it's going to be cashmere sweater time here, which I think it already is. So, okay, let's see what happens. Okay, so who would like to tell us about that? Any part of that. Before I start calling on you. Because not saying anything, uh-uh.
Raise your hand.
Come on. Every single one of you had something come up. Go on. You can do it. You can. You can raise your hand. I know you can do it. I know you can do it. Jessica, yes.
Well, what I was letting go of is the critic and the voice that says,
you aren't perfect and you should be, and you're worrying, you should be worrying, you're not worrying, you really should find something to worry about because everything is not fine, that voice. And what I'm making room for is what came to me as like a new mother, like a healing, loving, unconditional mother, the pet mother.
Pet mother. Thank you, Jessica. Somebody else? So, Angela, did you have your hand up? I saw that.
You caught me. So, what's changing and transforming for me, what I saw was how my relationship with my sons and how it's changing and transforming, and when I really allow myself to be myself and not give in to the, oh, I'm not important, I've done something wrong, I'm not loved. I saw that separation and that transformation, or the beginnings of, and the vision that I saw was a very bright, translucent light that I was inside of, and being drawn to this new space or area, realizing that, you know, I can love them, not really in a different way, but, you know, that love is still there.
Thank you. So somebody else, I like to hear what you know that you didn't know. Jacqueline?
Well, I'm not sure if that's what I'm going to answer, but I'm going to try. But
yeah.
In that process for me, I was journeying through my life of caregiving, like even as a young, very young person, like caring, make the house safe, and how I've evolved through life of being just an excellent caregiver, as a nurse, as a trade for my life. And then in my situation now with my husband who has Alzheimer's. And then I just broke and went into where I was like an amethyst stone. So I saw like the crusty edge of life, and then there's this brilliant blue coloring, and then just the curiosity and the wonder of who I might be without having a partner or being responsible for anyone but myself. Like, I don't think I even know, and I'm curious. So that was different for me. So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, Nancy, did you have your hand up too?
It's Kim. So this is kind of both what I'm letting go of and what I'm
creating. But what
creating.
Do you know that you didn't know?
That's what I'm going to say.
Okay.
So what I didn't know was the journey of the food was keeping me from knowing my being. Mm. And that's, I'm letting go of that journey and creating the journey of knowing me at the core.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Kim. Nancy.
So I just released a lot of sadness. I'm still trying to figure out what I didn't know. I guess I didn't know how good that would feel, because I think I try to hang on to it because I think it's going to be painful to let out. So.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. You know, one thing I want to say, you can take the mic, Judy, that I didn't say is about our extreme attachment to our wounds. Most all of us are attached to our wounds. We know who we are when we're wounded. We know that one. It occurred to me, was it last month? I can't remember when it was. I was working with myself about something. And I realized that I feel you know, the woundedness is it's such a familiar identity for me. It's so familiar. I kind of know who I am. I call it the gloomy doomies. I kind of know who I am. When it's in some way that I embody the atmosphere that I grew up in and as, and embody that one who can't do it, who did it wrong, somehow did it wrong, and that there is a draw to that. There's because it's so familiar, because it's been going on, I don't know about lifetimes. Many people say lifetimes in the plural. I'm just getting through this lifetime, so I don't really know about lifetimes and millennia, but I do know that as long as I've been alive, I have been identified with and often attached to, because I know who I am when I'm wounded. I know that one. I really do. I know that one. And I also know how to be the one who's going to fix that one. So I know how to be wounded, and I know how to work hard to fix the wounded one. Those are the things I know. And often you'll hear when somebody, you ask somebody, how are you? They'll start telling you what's wrong. Here's what's wrong. Here's what didn't happen. But to be utterly enchanted, and that this isn't really, words don't really describe this very well, but nonetheless, that's what we've got, so that's what I'm going to use, with the unwounded one, the freedom, the gloriousness, the luminosity, or else just the regular humdrum peace of it all, where nothing is wrong, feels, can sometimes, not the luminosity, but sometimes feel like, well, who exactly am I if I'm not that wounded one? And what I notice that when friends say, how are you? There's not much to say about it. I'm fine. When they say what's new and exciting. Well, I mean, now that I have a book coming out on April 21st, I can say, oh, my book is coming out on April 21st. I have a book coming out. But before I knew the date of the publication, which was just in the last couple weeks, there wasn't, if I didn't go back into, I had a terrible night's sleep and the organ recital and whatever I was annoyed with about Matt in that moment, if I didn't feel like magnet to steel on the woundedness, on that identity of knowing her, because I want to say about her, about our wounded selves, I want to remind you what Gabor Mate said. It's not what happened. It's how we interpreted what happened. That is the basis of the wound, which means that it's our creation. When we take ourselves to be our wounds, we take ourselves to be the self we created. Our creation. Our interpretation. We made it up. My mother didn't pick me up from kindergarten. I don't matter. That becomes the seed upon which one thing gets glommed onto and another thing gets glommed onto and another and another and another and another before I'm a big I don't matter. That started with the little seed of my mother. Now, this didn't happen, but didn't pick me up, or the day my mother says it never happened, she dragged me across the floor by my hair. Did she? I have no idea anymore. I remember this. I remember the wallpaper. I remember the shriek. I remember this. She says it didn't happen. I don't know what the fuck happened. I'm at this point of she says she didn't do it. I know memory is really self-constructed. It's really, really subjective. Did I create a whole child self? Did my mother ever hit me? Yes. My brother validates that. But, so he validates that. So what? So his memory, who knows anything? All I know is that I have constructed an identity from my wounds. And those wounds are my interpretations of what happened. I'm not saying that I grew up in a happy family. I did not. It was cruelty. It was abusive. It was unhappy. It was with two adults who didn't love each other, who were mean to each other. It was grisly. It was grisly. And I've said to my brother, I'm lucky we didn't become serial killers. That's what I have to say. And then while I was writing this book and I was writing about this, I looked up Charles Manson's mother. And I figured, okay, he was out of it. Turns out Charles Manson's mother traded him for a can of beer. And I realized, okay, that might be worse than my mother. My mother did. So, I feel fortunate I didn't become a serial killer. That because I didn't feel like my mother loved me, and da 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 da, and that also is the sum of my creation. Did my mother love me? I know that she loved me as best as she could love me. Her version of love. Does it matter at this point? It only matters if I keep seeing through my wounds. And it matters to the extent that my core beliefs, which form the core identity of a wounded being, are I don't matter, I'm not enough, my existence doesn't matter, I can never get it right. Often while I was writing this book, as I was hitting some really difficult places, I would just stop writing and say, I can't do this. I can't do it. And then I would come up with what it was like, and then I would really examine that particular conclusion. I'm not up to it. I'm just not up to it. This isn't for me. And I remember all the times, you know, where I'd get straight A's and a B, and my dad would say, what happened to the B? And I'd feel like I did the best I could. I can't do it any more than this. And that feeling of I just can't do it right would come up over and over and over again. And every time it came up while I was writing, I'd have to just look at it all over again. Until finally, when it would come up, I'd say, I know what this is. It's that. And it was a lie. But it probably took going through that 150, 200 times just while working on this book. I can't do it. I'm not up to it. So what we're doing is dismantling the me person's beliefs. We're dismantling all those glamons that we put. We're dismantling our attraction to and attachment to our wounds. Because most of us are more attached to the wounds than we are to being free. We'd much rather talk about the wounds than we'd like to be free. Because being free, we don't have a history for. And also, it's not, as Carolyn Mace calls it, woundology. Let me tell you about my wounds. Or as Eckhart Tolle calls it, the pain body. Needs something else to feed on. Every time we talk about our wounds, the pain body gets satisfied. Is it lunchtime? Okay. So let's tune in. Ooh, it is. It is. Okay. Let's tune in here to Hunger Scale. We're going to do an eating meditation now. Close your eyes. On a hunger scale of 1 to 10, 1 is really, really hungry, 5 is comfortable, 10 is stuffed. Where are you on that hunger scale? 4 or below, you're hungry, 5 or above, you're not. And it, see if you have a sense, regardless of what they're serving here, but have a sense of, would you like hot or cold? Would you like protein? Would you like something lighter than that? What is it that the beloved pet of your body, and it could just be a category of food because we're getting served food, you don't have a whole display of choices. And then on emotional hunger, 1 to 10, 1 is hungry, needy, sad, emotionally. 5 is fine, 10 is great. Where are you? Just knowing that. Knowing it, awareness is half of everything we're doing. Telling the truth, being aware. Awareness is like sunlight on mold. It's just shining the light. It is really like sunlight. Okay, everybody. So, again, we're in silence now for the meal and for the eating meditation. I'll see you in the dining room.